He happened to serve on the athletic council that helped recruit Bud Wilkinson to OU. Wilkinson led the Sooners to many victories over UT in one of college football's great rivalries. My future wife, Jill, knew our courtship was serious when I let her take possession of my season tickets. She was living in Austin, and I was working in D.C. when we met. In my youth, however, politics and current events, more than Longhorn sports, is what we spent time discussing and debating at our kitchen table. I learned that politics is a way to make a positive difference in people's lives. Granddad liked to say, "It's not the dollars you make, it's the difference you make," referring to what matters most in life. Growing up in the local political spotlight of Austin had its ups and downs. Our mother, the mayor, tried to keep things pretty normal, and my three older brothers and I never let things go too much to our heads. Mom used to remind me, "What your friends do is one thing. What you do could end up on the front page of the paper." We tried to avoid undue attention at all cost, while still taking life in a lighthearted way. Even if we were the mayor's kids, we were not about to let the pomp and ceremony of the political spotlight change who we were. Just kids trying to grow up and join ourselves in a middle-class family. Our mother did her best to keep us humble. I was none too happy the day she picked me up from junior high school and said we had to stop by a reception for the Texas A&M alumni downtown and had no time to stop by home. I wore my orange and white Texas number 1 t-shirt to school that day because it was the week of the UT-A&M football rivalry. Now she was unconvincingly telling me how the alumni of the arch-rival Texas Aggies would have no problem with it. "Oh, don't worry," Mom said. "They'll get a kick out of it. It'll be fun." Yeah, right, I thought. All I remember from the downtown business attire reception upstairs in a balcony was the slightly inebriated, loud Aggie alum who came up behind me and tried to lift my shirt over my head. His fellow alums nearby enjoyed a laugh at my embarrassed adolescent expense. "Yeah, tons of fun, Mom." Still, she did instill in my brothers and me the importance of public service as a way to make a positive difference and change things for the better. My brothers and I grew up in a Democratic household, as had my mother and father. Mom was considered a moderate to conservative Democrat, a political centrist, when she served as mayor of Austin, although in Texas, mayors and city council candidates do not run for office under any party label. Her coalition included the more affluent, conservative-leaning northwest part of the city and the heavily African-American east, with the liberal urban areas near the university tending to oppose her. Generally speaking, she worked to keep taxes down, make sure city services were fully funded, and preserve Austin's wonderful quality of life while promoting economic growth. At the time, Austin was in the midst of a significant growth spurt. Its population would go from 322,000 to 461,000 in just 10 years, and becoming a technology hub in addition to being a government and university town. Mom was plenty tough enough for the highly charged political environment, knowing how to form winning coalitions and finding common ground to get things done, at least until her third term when the coalition turned decidedly liberal. Spending a fair amount of time around City Hall and in the back of council chambers tagging along with Mom, I learned about the political art of deliberation, thoughtful persuasion, and compromise for getting things done. Austin politics could be rough, though, and it was difficult to ignore the uglier things people said about Mom. But my brothers and I never let our distress show outwardly. It is hard not to take things personally when it's your mom being attacked. But those tough boyhood lessons made it much easier for me not to take things personally later during my adult years in the rough-and-tumble world of politics. Probably the most disturbing part of Mom's mayoral days was the death threats she received. I believe it only happened a couple of times, each during one of her three campaigns. I recall one of my brothers picking up the phone and hearing some guy say, "I'm going to kill your mother." The threats never materialized, but I remember Mom attending a Little League baseball game of mine with some plainclothes Austin police officers who protected her around the clock when such a threat was made. Politics, I learned, has an ugly side that most people never fully appreciate. This realization instilled in me great respect for those willing to sacrifice much in order to serve. It also showed me that there are always going to be some people who are angry and hateful, and politics provides them a venue to vent their frustrations. You can't let that stop you from standing up for what you believe. As my granddad told my mother, "Carol, if you don't have somebody mad at you, you probably haven't done anything." My brothers and I attended public schools, participated in extracurricular activities, and played a variety of sports from baseball to basketball to tennis, with some sandlot football thrown in. We would get into fights every once in a while, as young brothers tend to do. Being close in age made us competitive, but it also made us close when we needed one another. Politics was something we each got involved with in school, too. Following the landmark 1971 Supreme Court ruling in Swan v. Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education, the Austin Independent School District was one of a number of cities nationwide under court order to use busing as a way to achieve school desegregation. White flight occurred in many parts of the nation after the ruling, including in Austin. From 1971 to 1972, a number of white families in Austin relocated to school districts neighboring the city. In 1972, my mother was one of three candidates elected to the Austin School Board who were opposed by a slate of anti-busing, some said pro-segregation, candidates. My mother won a seat on the board with 75% of the vote and still views with pride the way the school board peacefully and successfully integrated the schools during the 5 years she served. During my mother's time as a member, the board developed a sixth grade center plan as an initial step to desegregate the schools. Under the plan, students who had attended predominantly white neighborhood elementary schools were bused, along with students who attended heavily minority neighborhood schools, to a school between the two areas of Austin for their sixth grade year. My brothers and I were bused from our West Austin neighborhood, where kids attended Cassis Elementary School, to attend Baker's sixth grade center located in central Austin. Students from predominantly African American and Hispanic Ortega Elementary in East Austin were also bused to Baker. The school board did not believe this plan placed an undue burden on any one area by having kids from just a single neighborhood bused across town. Instead, students from both areas would be bused to an in-between point. I served as president of the student council at the Baker Sixth Grade Center. The school was diverse, quite a change from the neighborhood elementary school I had attended, which had only a small number of black and Hispanic students. I look back on my year at Baker with fondness. If there had been no busing, I might never have met Herman Hill, an African-American student who served as vice president of the student body. Despite hotly contesting my claim to being the better basketball player, Herman, more than 20 years later, agreed to be a member of my wedding party. At Baker, I also became friends with Heap Pham, a recent immigrant from Vietnam. Heap, a bright student who was still transitioning to English, used to refer to me affectionately as Chuck Norris, Chuck Norr, as he would say in his accent, and in response I called Heap, a young black belt, Bruce Lee. I did not study karate, but Heap tried to teach me a few moves. The lessons did not stick. Before she lost interest in me, my smart, pretty sixth-grade girlfriend was Camille Mojica, a Hispanic girl. Such a relationship was considered unusual in those days. In favoring racial integration, I was carrying on a family legacy that extended back beyond my mom's school board service. During Granddad's tenure as dean of the University of Oklahoma Law School, he testified in the case of Ada Lois Scipio Fisher, a black woman who was challenging the state's new segregated law school for black students, which was held in a small curtained-off area inside the Capitol building. The state had hastily opened the law school following the Supreme Court ruling in a previous case brought by Fisher that Oklahoma could not refuse to provide a legal education to all. Not surprisingly, she did not feel this was equal protection to which the 14th Amendment entitled her. Recalled former Texas law school professor and nationally renowned constitutional law expert Charles Allen Wright at a memorial service for my grandfather in 1999. She brought a new action in state court challenging the constitutionality of this instant law school. Called to testify by the attorney representing Fisher, future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, my grandfather stated that there was no way that the new law school could be considered equal to the long-established University of Oklahoma Law School. As Wright also noted in his eulogy, Granddad testified calmly and rationally, but a younger colleague on the faculty at OU Law School, who also sided with Fisher, was more emotional and less restrained in his comments. The younger professor's testimony led vocal supporters of segregation in Oklahoma to demand that the university board fire him. As dean, my grandfather sent a letter to the chairman of the Board of Regents standing up for the professor's right to freely express his views and pointing out how the national reputation of the university would be hurt if it fired a professor for stating his honest view about segregation. Granddad's defense of the professor prevailed. The chairman of the board later told him that had it not been for his letter, the professor would have been dismissed. Granddad would become known over the years for hiring top professors with diverse viewpoints and loyally speaking up for their right to academic freedom when their comments created controversy. Upon returning as dean, Granddad oversaw the peaceful integration of the University of Texas School of Law following the Supreme Court decision in Sweat v. Painter, another landmark case that had been working its way through the legal system while Granddad was at OU. My whole family was proud of our patriarch's championing of equal rights and freedom of speech, and my own interest in public service owes a lot to his inspiration. Eventually, I served as president of my junior high student council and then as student council president of Austin High School, the same one my mother had been president of 29 years before. During my time as Austin High student body president, I came to befriend a colleague who was president at Johnston High School in Austin, John Barr. He too had grown up around politics. His father was a close friend and advisor to then-Congressman J.J. Jake Pickle, the longtime representative from Austin who succeeded Lyndon Baines Johnson in Congress. The year we came to know each other, my mother was running against Pickle. She lost. Over the years, John and I have talked about how, despite being in opposite political parties, our political views are pretty closely aligned. We have often discussed the dangers to democracy posed by each party's hardline, uncompromising ideological purist. In high school, I gave up all sports, save for tennis, and ended up becoming a top-ranked singles and doubles player. Our high school team ended up number 2 in the state my senior year. I did well in high school, graduating with honors in the top 20% of my class, but not as well as my older brothers, who finished as valedictorian, valedictorian, and salutatorian, beaten out by his twin. After briefly entertaining the idea of attending the U.S. Naval Academy and playing tennis there, I decided to stay home and attend the University of Texas. I joined the fraternity where two of my brothers were members and pursued a degree in government. The tennis coach, Dave Snyder, offered me a non-scholarship position on the top-ranked tennis team as well. Coming to the realization that my chances were slim for taking it to the next level, I ended up quitting the tennis team halfway through my sophomore year. Midway through my junior year, I was elected president of the 120-plus member Sigma Phi Epsilon chapter for a one-year term. Fraternities at the time were undergoing closer scrutiny from the university and county attorney over concerns about continued hazing. Hazing was part of the culture in the UT fraternity system, and the system had a long history of national notoriety. It wasn't an element of university culture that I felt comfortable with. During my freshman year, Mark Seeberger, a pledge in another fraternity, died of alcohol poisoning in a hazing incident. Later, I lost a childhood friend and all-around nice guy, Scott Phillips, who joined a fraternal organization and got caught up in a hazing incident that resulted in his death. While serving as a pledge trainer, he fell off a cliff while being chased through a park by a group of young pledges engaging in a bit of reverse hazing. Incidents like these made me and others at UT feel that the hazing culture needed to change. Nationally, SIGEP headquarters was working diligently to steer its chapters in a new, more positive direction. Such a change can be hard to bring about, but I would try, in part by necessity and in part by choice after a regrettable experience on my watch as the chapter's president. I had taken over my presidential responsibilities just before Christmas break of my junior year. We had returned to school, and as was the tradition, the fall pledge class was going through its unsanctioned hell week. This included sleep deprivation and mostly verbal hazing, but some physical hazing as well. Having experienced hazing as a pledge, I came to view it as a peculiar way to instill brotherly love. During this particular hell week, however, things got out of hand. One pledge suffered eye injuries in a moment of near exhaustion from lack of sleep late one night. It was a freakish accident. Hair dye from a crazy costume donned as part of the hazing ritual ran into his eyes, partially blinding him. One of my fraternity brothers brought him down to my room at the fraternity house. We immediately had him taken to the emergency room, where he was treated and returned home early the next morning. At the time, doctors expressed concern that the eye injury could affect him for the rest of his life. Nevertheless, the pledge insisted he did not want to make an issue of what happened. I told him he needed to do what he felt was right, regardless of what it meant for others, but I also realized that the hazing problem was one our fraternity needed to deal with honestly and head-on, and that covering up an incident of this kind would not be constructive in the long run. After the volunteer alumnus chapter counselor and I discussed the matter, we agreed it was best to inform the chapter alumni board, which included lawyers who were rightly concerned about potential liability. I told the alumni I would accept responsibility for whatever needed to be done. They ultimately decided to handle things internally, but we all agreed that we had to end the hazing culture inside the fraternity once and for all. I stood up at chapter meetings and, in my role as president, strongly urged that Hell Week be eliminated in the future. This was a tough position for me to take. I was the one who had to bear the brunt of the criticism from fellow fraternity brothers who viewed hazing as something everyone does at UT and had done for a long time. They wondered why our chapter should change because of one incident involving a pledge who did not even hold the slightest grudge. The alumni board did little openly to back me. Perhaps understandably, they were squeamish about shouldering responsibility for this unpopular position. But despite being alone on this issue, I stuck to my guns. It cost me some friendships and created some vocal criticism. I held a firm line because I believed it needed to happen and it was the right thing to do. and some fraternity members joined with me. We effectively ended hazing within our fraternity, at least temporarily. Unfortunately, the change was short-lived. The following fall, a small group of members, after a drinking session, decided to take some pledges and show them what paddling felt like. After my attempts to have those involved punished, I came to a moment of truth. If the fraternity wanted to continue down the path of self-destruction at a time when attitudes were swiftly changing about the acceptability of such behavior, then it was their choice as undergraduates. But I was not going to be a part of it. I ended up resigning as fraternity president a few months early. At the same time, I remained active as one of four student leaders who worked with university administrators to develop ways to move beyond hazing. I eventually graduated, wondering how much progress we had really made trying to bring about positive change in the UT fraternity system. Nonetheless, I was convinced that it was the right thing to do. Nationally, SIGEP has taken a lead for many years to move beyond hazing, and I've heard reports that our Texas chapter has done the same in recent years as well. Unfortunately, despite continuing efforts to end hazing, this social evil continues at UT and elsewhere. The state of Texas has passed anti-hazing legislation, and UT has adopted strict rules forbidding hazing and requiring victims to report incidents to the dean's office. Over the years, several student organizations have been suspended for violating these rules. Yet hazing still goes on. In December 2005, a young pledge in the Lambda Phi Epsilon fraternity died as a result of a hazing incident. Consequently, the chapter was suspended until 2011, and three fraternity members received criminal indictments. It's terribly sad that tragedies like this continue to mar the fine record of an otherwise great institution like UT. This college experience left a lasting impression on me. Most significantly, it showed me how difficult it can be to change a negative culture that has grown up in an institution over time. No matter how obvious it may be that change is needed, and no matter how hard people of goodwill fight to create that change, social inertia and the selfish motivations of a few individuals who benefit from the existing regime make systemic reform very challenging. It's a lesson that those who want to fix Washington's broken political culture will need to take very seriously. Resigning as president of the fraternity in early fall 1989 opened the way for me to pursue another opportunity, one that turned out to be crucial for my career. I was about two semesters short of completing my coursework at UT, and I hadn't yet decided what I was going to do after graduation. Since I was taking a somewhat lighter course load at the time and had some additional free time without my fraternity obligation, I reached out to Bill Tryon, an alumnus who had belonged to Sigma Phi Epsilon my freshman and sophomore years and was now working on a Republican gubernatorial campaign. I told Bill I had some time available and would be interested in volunteering to see what a statewide political campaign was like. This was a natural outgrowth of my family history, and I liked the idea because I thought it might give me an opportunity to work in Austin. Why did I focus on an opportunity in the Republican Party? The choice didn't reflect a particularly strong ideological bent. Overall, I did feel more at home in the conservative-leaning Texas Republican Party, but my affiliation was more a matter of family history than rigid conservative belief. During the 1980s, I followed my mom and many other Texas Democrats in migrating to the Republicans. Texas had been a one-party state for more than 100 years, since the end of Reconstruction following the Civil War. Over the years, though, there had been a conservative wing and liberal wing in the Texas Democratic Party. Since 1980, Texas has voted Republican in presidential elections. Many Texas Democrats over the course of the 1980s believed the National Democratic Party had been moving too far left. My mother was one, as was I. She switched parties in 1985 during the period of the Reagan Revolution. She ran for Congress as a Republican the following year, losing to the incumbent, Jake Pickle. It was also the year I turned 18. In fact, the first vote I ever cast was for my mother in the Republican primary. In 1988, I cast my first presidential ballot for George H.W. Bush, whom I also got to meet for the first time during a campaign event for my mother. Little did I expect to get to know him personally more than 15 years later. Bill phoned me back that afternoon and asked if I'd be willing to work part-time on Clayton Williams' gubernatorial campaign as a press assistant. Williams was a charismatic businessman who had built himself a fortune through successful investments in natural gas, real estate, banking, and telecommunications. He even appeared in a series of popular television commercials for his own long-distance phone company, Claydesta, named after himself and his wife, Modesta, wearing a business suit and a cowboy hat. Williams promised to bring his authentic Texas style, his businessman's intelligence, and a tough anti-crime stance to the governor's mansion in Austin. But he was a novice politician, and his inexperience would prove fatal. After meeting with the press secretary, Bill Kenyon, I was hired on the spot and started work immediately. Among other duties, the job entailed getting to the office at 6 o'clock every morning before anyone else had arrived, going through the major newspapers, and clipping and copying noteworthy stories relating to the campaign and prominent state issues, so everyone, including the candidate, would have them to read right away. The 20 to 25 hours a week I committed to working quickly turned into 30 to 35. I'd signed on to the Williams for Governor campaign early, which is always a good move for a young, aspiring politico, and my dedication and hard work were noticed. Williams ended up winning the Republican primary overwhelmingly, defeating three notable rivals without a runoff, an impressive feat for a first-time candidate. The personal money he invested in the campaign helped, along with his down-home charm, and it looked as if he had great promise, capturing the electorate's perennial longing for something different from the typical politician. Shortly after the primary, Kenyon asked if I'd be interested in serving in a full-time press advance role, traveling ahead of Williams, the candidate, and making sure that public events, including news conferences, were properly staged with the right backdrops and visuals for the cameras and that Williams was fully briefed on the important aspects of the event. I jumped at the chance and put finishing school that summer on hold. It was exciting to move to the front lines of the campaign and have an opportunity to get to know the man who might be Texas's next governor. Williams came out of the primary in strong position and with growing momentum, leading his Democratic rival, the charismatic and beloved Ann Richards, by a seemingly insurmountable margin. Williams had a populist conservative appeal. He was perceived as an outsider and successful businessman who could take on the state's bureaucracy in Austin, streamline government, fight crime effectively, he would teach felons the joys of busting rock, and best represent the values shared by the majority in conservative-leaning Texas. Richards, though well-liked personally, was perceived by many as too progressive or liberal for the state, and her 1988 speech at the Democratic National Convention attacking Texan George Herbert Walker Bush only reinforced that image. Richards had served as a Travis County commissioner in Austin when my mother was mayor, so we'd crossed paths at political events when I was a kid. When Williams ran against her for governor, she was serving as the state treasurer. I knew she had lots of personal charm and would be difficult to beat, even when Williams was leading by 20 points after the primary. I viewed her as too left of center and knew she was vulnerable on the issues, but also knew she was adept at positioning herself publicly as more mainstream. Right after the primary, however, Williams' lack of political experience began to hurt him as he made a series of impolitic remarks and downright gaffes. For example, Williams refused to shake Richards' hand after an event, annoyed by an anonymous smear campaign against him that she had failed to denounce. But Texas men pride themselves on their gentlemanliness. And for Williams to publicly snub his opponent, and a lady at that, was viewed as beyond the pale. Much worse, however, was an ill-conceived joke Williams uttered during an informal press session at his ranch. The weather that day was lousy, and Williams quipped to a group of reporters that bad weather is a little like rape. As long as it's inevitable, just relax and enjoy it. This wasn't just a case of political incorrectness. It was a horrendously insensitive remark, and the fact that Williams was running against a woman only made the circumstances worse. I was informed later that as soon as the words were out of his mouth, Williams's press secretary quickly spoke up and told the assembled writers, "This is all off the record." But at least one reporter pointed out, quite correctly, that no one had agreed to anything of the kind, and all the reporters were soon writing about the comment. It was inevitable that Williams' remark would make its way into the headlines of the papers and the TV coverage, and it did the following day. Perhaps engaging in some wishful thinking, the candidate told his staffers that they were exaggerating the likely impact of his gaffe. Of course, he was way off base. The next day, the press secretary ordered me to collect all the news clips reporting and commenting on Williams' comment and get in early that weekend morning to answer phones so that the candidate could see for himself the depth and breadth of the public outrage. The phones in our campaign offices were ringing off the hook, and I was the only one initially answering them, as instructed. Texans took Williams' remarks very personally. I remember one caller tearfully talking about her sister's tragic rape, a violent assault that left her permanently disfigured and emotionally scarred, and demanding to know how a candidate for governor could joke about such things. I had no answer or excuses to offer. All I could do was express my sincerest sympathy and let her know I would make sure to pass along the message. I did, to Williams himself over speakerphone when Kenyon, the press secretary, called in and told me to read out some of the calls. One of my favorite classes at UT was a leadership course taught by Sarah Weddington, a longtime friend of Ann Richards who was known for her involvement representing the anonymous Jane Roe in Roe v. Wade. the case that made abortion legal across the United States. The class was relatively small by UT standards, and quite a few bright, politically engaged students were taking it, and it was always interesting and informative. I was still a part-time staffer on the Williams campaign at the time. Our debates were intense, but always cordial, except for the day after Williams's remark, when my more liberal-leaning classmates let me have it pretty hard. I eventually managed to get a word in and settle them down by letting them know that I agreed it was offensive and reminding them that I was not the one who said it. Thanks to these and other missteps, Williams' substantial lead in the polls dwindled to virtually nothing by Election Day, yet he still almost pulled it off because of his populist appeal. Richards came out on top with a very slim plurality. It was a painful learning experience for those of us who'd worked long hours for a candidate we considered bright and promising. Vowing not to return to the up-and-down world of political campaigns, I briefly joined a small business started by some campaign colleagues before deciding that the next summer I would go back and finish my undergraduate degree. But my vow to avoid political campaigns turned out to be temporary. After completing my degree that next summer, I spent 6 years bouncing back and forth among campaigns, grassroots political outreach, and Texas government. In 1994, at Mom's request, I managed her first successful campaign to statewide elected office. Following her victory over the Democratic incumbent, I was asked by a new state senator, Tom Haywood, to serve as his chief of staff. I had managed his previous campaign in 1992, which he'd narrowly lost to an entrenched incumbent against heavy odds. I became a close friend of Tom's, as well as of his dedicated daughter Denise, who kept close watch over her father's interests, especially after he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Tom's illness didn't prevent him from serving in the Senate, and I worked with him for 8 months, including getting him through his first legislative session as we agreed. Mom came knocking again for her re-election campaign, which she easily won. Then it was off to a government affairs position in the Lower Colorado River Authority, LCRA, a quasi-state agency, before managing Mom's next race, this time for the powerful position of Texas Comptroller. In each campaign also served as chief spokesman. In January 1999, I was expecting to return to my position with the LCRA when Governor Bush's communications director, Karen Hughes, came calling with an invitation that would change my life. Chapter 4. Governor Bush runs for president. While governor of Texas, George W. Bush used to say he thought it was the best job in the world. For the most part, I believe he really meant it, and knowing Bush the way I do today, I have come to appreciate why. Now, it is important to understand first that the Texas governorship is an inherently weak office constitutionally. The Constitution of 1876, written after the end of the Reconstruction period, when most Texans still harbored great resentment toward the centralized autocratic Republican administration that was imposed on them after the Civil War, substantially diminished the governor's powers in decentralized state government. The new Constitution distributed power among an array of independently elected state office holders, along with a part-time legislature. This so-called plural executive limits what the governor can do on his own, since the other officials with whom he shares power are elected on their own, are free to act independently, and may not entirely support his agenda. Nonetheless, the Texas governorship does carry significant influence if the person occupying the office knows how to use the bully pulpit effectively. The Texas governor also has the power of the veto, as well as the ability to appoint a significant number of individuals to powerful and prominent positions within state government, including university boards and key regulatory commissions. And he or she can call special sessions of the legislature, which in Texas's unique, some might say odd, system otherwise meets for only 4.5 months every other year. Relative to its power, the office also has a large staff and other perks and privileges, such as a mansion, a security detail, and the use of state government-owned planes. And it is considered the most prestigious state office, receiving far more media attention and public interest than any other. The office suited Bush's personal style well. He is someone who enjoys living a full and balanced life, and, like most politicians, he finds being around people invigorating and uplifting. He also values discipline and routine in his schedule. The power of the office gave him the ability to do something meaningful and fulfilling, influence the state's direction in a positive way. Its largely predictable and normal hours, coupled with its perks and privileges, gave him great flexibility to balance work, exercise, and leisure time. As we all should, Bush places great importance on daily exercise. I remember one day in 1997 when I was working at LCRA and had predictable normal hours myself. Back then, before suffering a knee injury, I used to run 3 to 4 miles a day. I had taken my lunch hour to go running on the nearby Town Lake Trail in Austin. As I was stretching and walking across the trail, just before starting my run, a guy in hat and sunglasses flew right by me. I might not have noticed him, but for the fact that he nearly plowed me over, which caused me to turn and see who it was. I saw a couple of guys follow on mountain bikes and another on foot. The guy in the hat was Governor Bush, who was sprinting as he finished his run for the day, and the guys trailing him were part of his protective detail. Bush also used to like lifting weights at the nearby UT athletic facility around lunch hour a few times a week and had the flexibility to be able to do so. The prestige of his job provided him frequent access to a wide range of people, especially good, ordinary Texans, whom he could meet, greet, and address in speeches. I imagine there are few people, given the same opportunity, who would not enjoy such a prestigious, influential, and largely comfortable job. I found working for Bush in the governor's office beginning early 1999 to be rewarding and challenging. There were always a variety of issues or events to address, including his all but officially announced presidential campaign. In my position as Deputy Communications Director, I had frequent interaction with Governor Bush as I responded to press inquiries, attended public events with him in Austin and around the state, and wrote press releases and statements for him, among other duties. I started getting to know him as a person and a leader, and began to form a personal bond with him. A governor's entourage, unlike that of a U.S. president, tends to be intimate and fairly small, and Bush always preferred it that way. He never much cared for a lot of people trying to handle him, follow him, or tell him where to go or what to say. On trips as governor, it was not uncommon for him to be accompanied only by a personal aide, his spokesman, and 2 or 3 members of his protective security detail, who were the best officers the Texas Department of Public Safety had to offer. There are a few moments that I still remember well from those 6 months I spent in the governor's office before heading over to the presidential campaign. It was in the governor's communications office that I first confronted a life-and-death policy issue, the death penalty. Governor Bush took a pretty tough line on stays and commutations. He believed that the death penalty helped save innocent lives through its deterrent effect. In his view, if the convicted felon had been afforded full access to the courts and there was no question about his or her guilt, then it was not the governor's place to overrule a jury. In any case, by state law, his options were limited to 1 30-day stay, and he could commute the sentence only if he received a recommendation to do so from the Texas Pardons and Parole Board, whose members are appointed by the governor. As a spokesman, I had to respond to inquiries about specific cases as well as questions about how Governor Bush reviewed them before signing death warrants. As the son of a former president and a possible future presidential contender, George W. Bush attracted more national scrutiny than other Texas governors had. Issues related to the death penalty were among the more contentious. Texas resorts to execution at a higher rate than any other state in the Union, and during Bush's tenure as governor, the death penalty was implemented 152 times, a number that caused considerable controversy. Those executed include a handful of felons whose IQs were below what is often considered the threshold for mental retardation, as well as Carla Faye Tucker, a born-again Christian whose 1998 case attracted pleas for clemency from Pope John Paul II and prominent conservatives, including Newt Gingrich and Pat Robertson. In any case, the death penalty was probably the first significant issue I had to deal with directly in the media where my view was not in line with Bush's. While I firmly believe in taking a tough stance on crime, I've always harbored some doubts about capital punishment. My thinking is grounded in a moral belief. I'm deeply troubled by the idea that even one innocent person could fall through the system and be put to death for a crime that he or she did not commit. I believe life without parole, which segregates convicted criminals from society, can serve the same purpose, keeping that individual from ever harming another innocent person without forcing society to play a role that I believe is not ours to play. Such a convicted felon should be held in virtual solitude under maximum security and treated humanely, but with few, if any, privileges of a free society. I also question, as have studies over the years, whether the death penalty has much of a deterrent effect. To be clear, I'm not staunchly anti-death penalty. If ever there is a case in which it is deserved, it would be those responsible for planning the 9/11 attacks. For me, the issue is too complex and too nuanced for a black-and-white position, but I do feel significant doubts about it, much as I would later feel about the necessity of war in Iraq. another life and death policy matter where I was called on as official spokesman to defend a position despite inner qualms about it. I didn't express my doubts about the death penalty publicly. After all, I was speaking for the governor, not myself. He was an unapologetic supporter of the death penalty, a position he had clearly articulated while running for the governorship and which the majority of Texans supported. Furthermore, the death penalty was Texas law. Even if the governor had not agreed with it, he had an obligation to uphold the laws of Texas and carry them out faithfully. For all these reasons, I told myself my personal doubts didn't really matter. On Governor Bush's behalf, I issued statements defending his position and responded to the controversies the way he wanted me to. That's what a spokesman does. Another notable moment occurred when a stricter Texas law against driving while intoxicated was passed. After determined lobbying by leaders of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, MAD, the Texas legislature passed a law in 1999 lowering the blood alcohol limit in Texas from 0.10 to 0.08. I remember suggesting to Karen Hughes that it might be good to hold a public signing ceremony for the bill so that the governor could underscore the importance of the new law. Karen replied, "Oh, he won't want to do anything public on it. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I think there is something in his past." I found her response notable, but didn't think a lot more about it at the time. I'm not sure exactly why. Probably the press of daily business simply pushed the issue to the side, until later events just before Election Day in 2000 made me recall the exchange with Karen and think about it in a new light. Overall, my time in the governor's office was a good experience. I learned a lot about government, politics, and the art of communication. I helped support an administration that was producing good bipartisan results for the state and the people of Texas. And I was playing a meaningful role in the career of a promising politician considered by many people to be a possible future president of the United States. All of this was heady, exciting stuff. I enjoyed some delightful moments of personal bonding with Bush, flying on a small plane with just the two of us sitting up front or chatting with him in the governor's office. One of my favorite moments occurred on the day I was the first to arrive for a meeting to review bills from the just-completed legislative session that the governor might veto. Since I had arrived early, the governor invited me back to the kitchen where he was fixing himself one of his favorite lunches, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Dressed down in a white t-shirt and blue jeans sans shoes, he asked if I wanted a sandwich. I said sure, and he fixed it for me. For the next 20 minutes or so, we munched on the sandwiches and talked about a variety of topics, few of which had to do with politics. Not long after I was beginning to settle into the quieter times in the governor's communications office following the legislative session and the bill signing period that succeeded it, Karen Hughes, then communications director for the Bush 2000 campaign, asked me to make another move. This time, in late July 1999, it was to join the now full-throttle presidential campaign as a deputy press secretary. Someone was needed to help fill the void left by departing national spokesman David Beckwith, a veteran Washington political communicator and former vice presidential spokesman. I had come to know Beckwith back in 1992 when he worked in Texas for then U.S. Senate candidate Kay Bailey Hutchison. I liked Beckwith, but Karen viewed him as a loose cannon who was less cautious and was not as on message as she preferred. Karen had come to trust me to proceed cautiously and stay on message, and she felt I had a good sense of the tone Bush preferred to set in his comments. I gained some valuable experience dealing with the national press during the lead-up to the primaries and early primary states. I spent most of my time responding to press inquiries from a variety of journalists and news organizations, both in person and on the phone, and participating in communications strategy meetings. As Governor Bush seemed to be on his way to securing the nomination, Karen approached me about becoming the traveling press secretary when the campaign shifted to the general election. Karen would continue to travel regularly as the chief spokesman for the campaign, but with a full press entourage following the nominee's every move, another spokesman was needed on the road. I enthusiastically accepted the offer. The primary victory was not secured as quickly or as easily as we thought it would be. Senator John McCain won a surprising victory in New Hampshire, followed by a Bush comeback in a hotly contested South Carolina race. Charges of smear tactics, dirty tricks, and other below-the-belt negative attacks flew back and forth beginning in the South Carolina contest and continued through the remainder of the primary battle, creating bitterness that I imagine endures in some quarters to this day. You may be wondering whether such bare-knuckle campaign tactics are one of my targets when I decry the excessiveness of Washington's permanent campaign and its scorched-earth politics. I certainly don't advocate or condone distorting an opponent's record, disseminating lies about him, or spreading innuendo through whispering campaigns, and it's the media's job to help sort out the truth in such circumstances. But I am less concerned about tough election campaigns than I am about such tactics seeping into the conduct of governance. Harsh electoral tactics are as old as democracy itself. But once the election is over, elected officials of both parties, especially those in positions of leadership, owe it to the public to work together on solving the country's problems through deliberation and compromise. For most of American history, they have done just that, even after hard-fought, even brutally negative election campaigns. We've had our share of those in Texas. We need to find a way to return to that tradition. McCain rebounded from the South Carolina loss with a win in Michigan, but it was his final hurrah for the 2000 season, as Bush went on to sew up the nomination. Political campaigns are often described as organized chaos. Presidential campaigns are organized chaos on a massive scale. There are many different areas of focus, from fundraising to outreach to strategy to communications to advance work to policy to research to event planning, and each involves keeping multiple plates spinning at the same time. During the primary campaign, I spent most of my time serving as a press spokesman, responding to media inquiries, doing interviews, and participating in communication strategy meetings and discussions. After being named traveling press secretary for the general election, I spent the majority of my time on the road as part of Bush's traveling team. On non-travel days, I would return to doing phone, radio, and television interviews from campaign headquarters and sitting in on morning senior staff meetings where we would discuss communication strategy, including talking points and the message of the day. My memories of the campaign trail are a whirlwind of plane flights, motorcades, press buses, hotel rooms, large rallies, and traveling media relations. I coordinated messages and responses on the road with Karen Hughes, the chief spokesman, and from the road with the communications team back at our headquarters in Austin, including our national spokesman, Ari Flesher, and rapid response director, Dan Bartlett. Part of my role was to function as an early warning detector and gather intelligence for the campaign. By establishing close relations with the reporters who covered Bush on the road, including consistently hanging out in their midst, I picked up useful bits of information, developing storylines that needed our input, incoming attacks from the opposition, or views of the internal Gore campaign from their colleagues covering the Democratic roadshow. As in any strategic battle, it's always good to know the opposition's mood and frame of mind. The campaign was also a chance for me to get to know Bush better, since I spent much of my time in close proximity to him, including briefing him and filling him in on relevant communications information, often alongside Karen Hughes. The rigors of a presidential campaign demand discipline, energy, and focus from a candidate. The travel is grueling, often including multiple events in multiple cities on any given day, with perhaps 1 or 2 days at home following several days on the trail. The candidate is constantly in the spotlight, giving speeches, being interviewed, attending fundraisers, shaking hands on rope lines, and yes, holding babies. He has to be on his game every minute of every day. Bush dealt with the pressures remarkably well. He made time to clear his head, work out, and get a good night's rest, at least most of the time. He also understood the importance of pacing himself. A campaign is a marathon, which Bush recognized from watching and advising his father in 1988. He also had a great ability to stay focused on the big picture and not worry about the process stories, day-to-day analysis of the minutiae of the horse race that the press likes to report, but which often has less interest among the general public. Bush also understood the importance of keeping his sense of humor, particularly as the campaign heated up. He is famous for his locker room antics, and rather than adding to the existing literature, I will leave those stories in the locker room. But I will say that we had some great fun, particularly during our final campaign swing. The end was near, one way or the other, or so we thought. And after months of travel, we would soon be heading home. Keeping things lighthearted behind the scenes helps the candidate and everyone else survive the intense, pressure-filled campaign environment without losing their sanity. Bush liked to tease traveling staffers by asking toward the end of the day if they were tired from working so hard. He had a subtle way of hooking his prey. If they said they were, he would tell the other staffers present how tired that person was and what a hard day he had had. Then he would ask the staffer, "How many speeches did you give today? How many hands did you shake?" It was a humorous way of reminding us who had to do the heaviest lifting any given day on the road. It was a routine Bush tended to recycle during the 2000 campaign and on longer trips, too. And yes, I recall him falling for it once. One night near the end of the campaign, the governor turned around from his aisle seat at the front of the campaign plane and pointed at a staffer in the last row of the staff section, just a few seats behind him. The staffer, Eric Terrell, signed checks for minor traveling expenses. He was a soft-spoken, low-key individual who was easy to overlook. To Bush, he was Check Dude, a nickname he'd been given early in the campaign. Eric had bet several of his road crew colleagues that he could go the whole campaign traveling with Bush without Bush knowing his actual name. But that night, Bush turned around, pointed to him, and said, "Eric Terrell, you're Eric Terrell. I got you. You're nailed." As Governor Bush grinned triumphantly, Eric had to pay up on his losing bets. In retrospect, one memorable moment I experienced while traveling with Governor Bush early in the campaign revealed more than just the repulsive tendency of contemporary Washington to spend an inordinate amount of time dredging into a candidate's personal past. It also showed a rather intriguing side of Bush's personality, one that proved significant at times in his presidential administration. My recollection is that we were campaigning in the Midwest. It was not long after Bush had effectively secured the Republican nomination. Karen had been traveling during the hectic and fiercely fought Bush-McCain primary showdown, so she decided to stay home and focus on the bigger strategic picture for the general election, away from the demands of the road, while I stayed with the governor as the sole spokesman. Following a campaign event, we arrived at a local hotel, where the campaign had a few rooms reserved for some downtime. Governor Bush and I were visiting as we headed to his suite. His personal aide, Logan Walters, was in tow along with some Secret Service agents. On the way upstairs, Bush began asking questions and chatting about what was on the press corps' mind. As we approached his room, I mentioned that the cocaine issue was continuing to peek out from the shadows of the campaign. Reporters early in the campaign had questioned Bush about whether he had used cocaine in his young adulthood. Rumors had circulated, but nothing had ever been substantiated. Bush had consistently brushed aside questions about his past with a deliberately ambiguous quip. "When I was young and irresponsible, I was young and irresponsible." Most reporters and commentators, and most voters too, I would bet, understood the message. Bush was, in effect, acknowledging that he had made some mistakes involving drinking and drugs, while at the same time refusing to be drawn into an endless line of questioning about exactly what he'd done and how it might affect his fitness for office so many years later. Bush would then segue into the broader point he wanted to emphasize. The most important message baby boomers such as himself could send to their children is that they have learned from experience and that their children should avoid repeating their mistakes. In August 1999, a veteran Texas political reporter, Sam Adelsey of the Dallas Morning News, was able to elicit a new response and partial answer from Bush on the matter. The question centered on whether Bush could meet the standard in the FBI background check for security clearances of some federal appointees, which asked about drug use in the past 7 years. Bush answered that he could, and confirmed that he had not used cocaine in that time period. The next day, he was asked if he could have met the standard during his father's administration, when he served as an informal advisor to the elder Bush. At that time, it was the past 15 years. Bush said he could, laying down a marker that he had not used cocaine at least since 1974. After that, he returned to the young and irresponsible quip and made clear he was not going any further. Nevertheless, news stories and columns periodically returned to the topic. Some critics asserted that it was a relevant issue. They suggested it was hypocritical for Bush to advocate tough mandatory sentences for users of relatively small amounts of cocaine if he had used it in his past, particularly when he hadn't faced any serious consequences for doing so. All of this was in the background of the conversation that Bush and I were having on our way to his hotel suite somewhere in the Midwest. I mentioned to the governor that the local paper had run a tacky picture of him next to a story about the cocaine rumors. The photo was a headshot of Bush with his index finger touching the tip of his nose. The gesture, of course, was purely coincidental, but alongside the adjacent story, it appeared at least suggestive. Bush shook his head incredulously and sighed, "Unbelievable, you gotta be kidding." As we arrived at the suite, the governor invited me to follow him into the back room. Logan stayed behind in the living room area, arranging for the governor to take a phone call from a supporter. Bush motioned for me to sit and relax in his room while he took the call. I didn't know who was on the other end of the line, but from the tone of the conversation, I could tell the supporter was probably a major contributor, though not necessarily a longtime friend. Bush had my comments about the picture in the local paper fresh on his mind. He brought up the issue behind it on the call. "The media won't let go of these ridiculous cocaine rumors," I heard Bush say. You know, the truth is, I honestly don't remember whether I tried it or not. We had some pretty wild parties back in the day, and I just don't remember. The overheard comment struck me, and it stayed with me to this day, not for what it revealed or concealed about the young George W. Bush, but for what it said about Bush as an older man and political leader, especially as revealed through my later experiences working for him. I remember thinking to myself, how can that be? How can someone simply not remember whether or not they used an illegal substance like cocaine? It didn't make a lot of sense. I compared Bush's memory, or lack of it, to my own experience. When I was young, I had my moments of excessive drinking at parties or out on the town with friends. There was also a time or two when I was around others who smoked marijuana. But I always drew the line at illegal drugs. The closest I ever came was holding a smoldering joint in my hand at a friend's home, gazing at it for a second as if tempted, more to tease my friends than anything else, and then passing it along to the person next to me, saying something like, "Thanks, but no thanks." After that happened a couple of times, my buddies knew better than to even tempt me. Whether or not I smoked pot isn't that important. The point is, I know what happened. I remember. And I found it hard to understand how George Bush could say he simply had no idea about what happened in his own past. I know Bush, and I know he genuinely believes what he says. He isn't the kind of person to flat-out lie, particularly when speaking in private to a supporter or friend. So I think he meant what he said in that conversation about cocaine. It's the first time when I felt I was witnessing Bush convincing himself to believe something that probably was not true and that deep down he knew was not true. And his reason for doing so is fairly obvious: political convenience. He is certainly not the only politician to embrace the hazy memory defense, especially in our ever more transparent political culture where voters are exposed to more outlets for news than ever before, and just about everything is considered fair game to some. In the years to come, as I work closely with President Bush, I would come to believe that sometimes he convinces himself to believe what suits his needs at the moment. It is not unlike a witness in court who does not want to implicate himself in wrongdoing, but is also concerned about perjuring himself. So he says, "I do not recall." The witness knows no one can get into his head and prove it is not true, so this seems like a much safer course than actually lying. Bush, similarly, has a way of falling back on the hazy memory defense to protect himself from potential political embarrassment. Bush rationalizes it as being acceptable because he is not stating unequivocally anything that could be proven false. If something later is uncovered to show what he knew, then he can deny lying in his own mind. In other words, being evasive is not the same as lying in Bush's mind. The former is acceptable, but the latter is not. I've seen it happen during other private moments around people he trusted, as well as times during press availabilities and news conferences. Self-deceit is a human quality, and we all engage in it at times. But for politicians, it tends to be more discernible and probably more pronounced because of the intense spotlight they are under. Bush is certainly not the first or the last politician to deceive himself, but the extent to which he resorts to self-deception beyond personal matters, which one can argue should be off-limits anyway, and the sincerity with which he embraces self-deluding beliefs amount to a personality trait that goes directly to larger issues of character and leadership style and carry over into real issues of governance. Another memorable moment was the time late in the presidential campaign when it was revealed that Bush had been convicted for driving under the influence of alcohol during a stay at the family home in Kennebunkport when he was in his mid-20s. The momentum seemed to be with us in those final days, largely because Bush had essentially come out ahead during the 3 October debates. Bush had exceeded low expectations during the debates, whereas Gore had not met high expectations that he would decisively dominate Bush. Gore's first debate performance, marked by sighs and exaggerations, played right into our hands. A key message we'd developed to undermine Gore's credibility was that he would say or do anything to get elected. Gore did not let us down, as comments he made and actions he took frequently underscored that perception in many voters' minds. It contrasted well with one of our key underlying messages, that Bush was honest and could be trusted to do what was right, not what was politically most convenient. Now, 4 days before the election, Bush had just finished a rally in Chicago. I was heading toward the buses that would transport the traveling press corps back to our campaign plane when Karen told me that a local Fox News station in Maine would be reporting that evening that George W. Bush had been convicted of driving under the influence as a young man in his 20s. I immediately thought back to my conversation with Karen a year earlier, when she'd said Governor Bush would prefer to avoid highlighting a law against drunken driving because of something in his past. Suddenly, Karen's words took on a specific meaning. Minutes after my conversation with Karen in Chicago, Carl Cameron, the national Fox News political correspondent who covered the campaign as a member of the traveling press corps, approached me, indicating he had heard the news too, I believe, via the local station through his network. He told me he was going to air with it at the top of the approaching evening news hour with Britt Hume back in Washington. I contacted Dan Bartlett, who is our rapid response director back in Austin. One chief responsibility of the rapid response director is to keep close tabs on the opposition and find ways to put him or her on the defensive, such as pointing out when the opponent is saying one thing but has a history of doing the opposite. Another chief duty is to coordinate the campaign's efforts to quickly respond in the same news cycle to incoming attacks or damaging breaking news about its candidate. If it is an attack from an opponent, then the rapid response effort is usually aimed at counterpunching to avoid being put on the defensive. If it is damaging news, then the response usually tries to change the focus in the media, possibly by finding a way to frame it as nothing but a dirty trick from the opposition. I told him my efforts to hold off Cameron until we could get him some comment for the record were not proving successful. So Dan spoke with him and gave Cameron our initial response. It's an old political truism. A candidate who has something controversial in his past needs to get it out early and on his own terms. Otherwise, his opponents may choose the time and manner of its release, usually calculated to maximize the political damage. This is why smart campaign teams perform opposition research, OPPO, not just on their opponents, but on themselves, using public information sources as well as undercover investigations to find out the worst about their own candidate. After all, if we can discover embarrassing information about our candidate on the internet, in old newspaper files, or in public documents, the bad guys can discover it too. Everyone on the Bush team was aware of this principle, of course. I never had the impression that more than a few, if even that many, of Bush's top political advisors were aware of the DUI conviction. My conversation with Karen Hughes from a year before would lead me to believe that she had only a general sense of it, but did not know any specifics. My conclusion was based on knowing Karen and the vagueness of her language, something in his past. By the time we finished the final event of the evening, Bush knew he had to address the media feeding frenzy about the DUI story. Breaking so late in the campaign, this story had the potential to alter the race. All the rumors about Bush's wild days of young adulthood were dramatically resurfacing with specific, documented evidence. Bush told the assembled traveling press corps following his Wisconsin stop that the DUI story was, in essence, correct. "I've oftentimes said that years ago I made some mistakes," Bush said. "I occasionally drank too much. I did on that night. I was pulled over. I admitted to the policeman that I had been drinking. I paid the fine. I regretted that it happened. I learned my lesson." He had not disclosed the DUI conviction publicly before, he continued, because he did not want his daughters to know about it. He had told them as a dad not to drink and drive because he did not want them doing the things he had done. Bush went on to talk about the suspicious timing of the news break, raising questions about whether it was politically motivated. It was an attempt to shift the topic of conversation from Bush's own misdeeds to the behavior of the opposition, in hopes that public revulsion against negative campaigning would produce a backlash against the Democrats. And indeed, a television reporter in Maine who first got the scoop later acknowledged that she'd been given the information by a local Democratic activist, a delegate to the Democratic National Convention. What impact did the DUI story have on the extraordinarily close 2000 election? It's hard to say. Karl Rove, George Bush's chief campaign strategist, believed the revelation was responsible for the Republican loss of Maine, where the news had originated, as well as the loss of enough support nationally to cost Bush the popular vote and send the election into overtime. By undermining Bush's campaign refrain about restoring honor and dignity to the White House, the revelation likely led some social conservatives to sit out the presidential race rather than cast a ballot for a candidate they now perceived as flawed. As for me, the DUI story didn't have much effect on my attitude toward George Bush or his presidential campaign. I'd signed on as a Bush supporter because I believed he could serve as a uniting force to help the nation overcome its bitter partisan divide, and I still felt that was true. I didn't consider the mishandling of the DUI case a serious misdemeanor on the part of George Bush, but a minor peccadillo driven by understandable motives. the desire to avoid political embarrassment over something personal from his past, and a father's reluctance to expose a seamy episode from his past to his impressionable teenage daughters. Most important, the story did not reveal anything detrimental about Bush's ability to govern. The offense had occurred many years ago, and Bush had given up alcohol altogether more than a decade earlier. In any case, the crime had not involved violation of the public trust. Driving under the influence is serious and can lead to tragic consequences, but I don't think a single episode of DUI automatically disqualifies a person from public office, unlike crimes like bribery, embezzlement, or fraud, for example. However, there is an important political lesson that could have been applied to more important matters of governance later in his presidency. While Bush addressed the DUI story head-on and did so well, it was too little, too late, and on someone else's terms. He allowed it to become a greater controversy than it needed to be by not dealing with it early and on his terms. The result was that it added unnecessarily to the suspicions some had about his strength of character and future ability to lead as president. It would not be the last time Bush mishandled potential controversy. But the cases to come would involve the public trust, and the failure to deal with them early, directly, and head-on would lead to far greater suspicion and far more destructive partisan warfare. In any case, the election came down to the wire with the two candidates neck and neck, and as everyone knows, it led to one of the most contentious and protracted electoral battles in American history. My memories of the Florida recount, like my memories of the campaign, are a whirlwind, this time a whirlwind of moving from county to county across central and southeast Florida to oversee on-the-ground communications efforts and make sure they were helping to inform and favorably shape public opinion. On election night, Bush led Gore in Florida by about 2,000 votes out of nearly 6 million cast. The extremely small margin triggered an automatic statewide recount under the state's election laws. Florida's 25 electoral votes would decide the contest, since neither Bush nor Gore had the necessary electoral votes without it. In addition to the automatic county-by-county machine recount, the Gore campaign decided to seek manual hand recounts of every ballot in a few select counties, and the legal battle that ensued over the constitutionality and fairness of the recount.